Our message today is titled Ichabod, and we'll be reading from 1 Samuel chapter 4. And the word of Samuel came to all Israel. Now Israel went out to battle against the Philistines and encamped beside Ebenezer. And the Philistines encamped in Aphek. Then the Philistines put themselves in battle array against Israel. And when they joined battle, Israel was defeated by the Philistines, who killed about 4,000 men of the army in the field. And when the people had come to the camp, the elders of Israel said, "Why has the Lord defeated us today before the Philistines? Let us bring the Ark of the Covenant from Shiloh to us, that when it comes among us, it may save us from the hand of our enemies." So the people sent to Shiloh that the Ark, or that they may bring from there the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord of Hosts, who dwells between the cherubim. And the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, were there with the Ark of the Covenant of God. And when the Ark of the Covenant of the Lord came into the camp, all Israel shouted so loudly that the earth shook. Now when the Philistines heard the noise of the shout, they said, "What does this sound of great shout in the camp of the Hebrews mean?" Then they understood that the Ark of the Lord had come into the camp. So the Philistines were afraid, for they said, "God has come into the camp." And they said, "Woe to us, for such a thing has never happened before. Woe to us, who will deliver us from the hand of these mighty gods? These are the gods who struck the Egyptians with all the plagues in the wilderness. Be strong and conduct yourselves like men, you Philistines, that you do not become servants of the Hebrews, as they have been to you. Conduct yourselves like men and fight." So the Philistines fought, and Israel was defeated, and every man fled to his tent. There was a great slaughter, and there fell of Israel 30,000 foot soldiers. Also the Ark of God was captured, and the two sons of Eli, Hophni and Phinehas, died. Then a man of Benjamin ran from the battle line the same day, and came to Shiloh with his clothes torn and dirt on his head. Now when he came, there was Eli sitting on a seat by the wayside watching, for his heart trembled for the Ark of God. And when the man came into the city and told it, all the city cried out. When Eli heard the noise of the outcry, he said, "What does the sound of this tumult mean?" And the man came quickly and told Eli. Eli was 98 years old, and his eyes were so dim that he could not see. Then the man said to Eli, "I am he who came from the battle, and I fled from the battle line." And he said, "What happened, my son?" So the messenger answered and said, "Israel has fled before the Philistines, and there has been a great slaughter among the people. Also, your two sons, Hophni and Phinehas, are dead, and the Ark of God has been captured." Then it happened, when he made the mention of the Ark of God, that Eli fell off the seat backward by the side of the gate, and his neck was broken, and he died. For the man was old and heavy, and he had judged Israel 40 years. Now his daughter-in-law, Phinehas' wife, was with child, due to be delivered. And when she heard the news that the Ark of God was captured and that her father-in-law and her husband were dead, she bowed herself and gave birth, for her labor pains came upon her. And about the time of her death, the women who stood by her said to her, "Do not fear, for you have borne a son." But she did not answer, nor did she regard it. Then she named the child Ichabod, saying, "The glory has departed from Israel, because the Ark of God had been captured, and because of her father-in-law and her husband." And she said, "The glory has departed from Israel, for the Ark of God has been captured." Let's all stand, and we'll pray as we get ready to worship.
Good morning, everybody. That was exciting, wasn't it? Yeah, Sasha, you're right. We should have done a different video. We'll come back to that. That's the Ark of God. That's from the Old Testament. That's literally God describing how he wants this wooden box to be built and made. Good to see you all. You're going to want to have your Bibles open to chapter 4. We'll get into 5 and 6 today, Lord willing. Until we start moving through that, I want to recap chapter 3, where we came from about a month ago. And then we'll talk about chapter 4 first, where Jason read before we did worship. So chapter 3 of Samuel, we're introduced, in fact, it's chapters 1 through 3. We're introduced to a new set of characters in God's story. There's these priests, it's Eli and his two sons. And there's this young boy named Samuel who comes into the picture, and he's really going to be the main character. God's going to raise him up as a prophet, as a spiritual leader for the people. And so from chapters 1 through 3, we kind of got the picture there. Problem with that is Samuel's only about 10 or 12 years old at this moment. Okay, his ministry technically has started, but there's sort of this time of waiting for the people to acknowledge him as a legitimate spiritual leader. They're impressed with him, and yet they won't really start listening to him for another 20 years or more. But so what we're talking about, chapters 4, 5, and 6 today, kind of is in this in-between time while the people are still under bad leadership in the church, in the tabernacle, and they're kind of waiting on Eli to step forward. Now, like I said, his ministry had begun. Okay, he had already heard a word from the Lord. He delivered this prophecy back in chapter 3 where he tells this older high priest named Eli. Now, get this. Samuel's 10 or 12 years old, okay, and Eli's in his 90s. This 10 or 12-year-old boy comes up to him and says, God is going to take away your ministry. You and your sons are going to die. That's the first exercise of ministry from Samuel the prophet. Okay, and so this expectation is coming, and it doesn't take too long to get there. That's where we are this morning. But that's the setup to chapter 4 where we find ourselves today. This young boy, I mean, picture any redheaded young man in the second row there going up to, where's Richard? Is he here today? Okay. And delivering this strong message from the Lord. But the people of Israel are in a bad place spiritually right now. So let's talk chapter 4 next. Okay, they're in a bad place spiritually. They go out to battle with the Philistines, and this is a normal thing for them. I mean, this is as much playground bullying, playground fighting, as it is warfare, although it is large armies at war. But they're in this constant fight with the Philistines. In our chapter 4 today, we find that they lose a battle with the Philistines. Okay. Apparently, they're wondering where God was in all this. They're wondering why God didn't bless their efforts on the battlefield. And so quickly, they pivot. And they say, well, let's go again. Let's try this again. But this time, let's bring the Ark of God with us. Let's literally carry God into the battle with us. That way we guarantee that he's there. Well, that doesn't go so well. They end up losing that battle. Beyond that, they lose the Ark. Okay, this wooden box that we just watched the AI video on. By the way, who says AI doesn't make your life better? Okay. They lose the Ark. And then the outcome of the chapter is that Eli and his sons die as promised, as predicted. Sons die in the battle. Eli dies probably of a heart attack. Then he falls over and breaks his neck. And then we get this picture of one of Eli's daughter-in-laws. She goes into labor prematurely. She gives birth. And it's such a bitter moment for her. Her husband had just died. Her father-in-law, the high priest, had just died. And the ark is now lost. And she names the boy Ichabod, okay, which basically means the glory has departed. The glory of God has departed. And that's the chapter. That's chapter 4. But I'll just submit to you that Israel was in a kind of a spiritually confused place. I don't think they had a direction. I don't think they had a clear direction on where they were supposed to be going. And part of that was a leadership problem. The high priest was lazy. He was old and lazy and kind of just done fighting. The other priests didn't really know how to do their job. We learned from chapters 1, 2, and 3 that they were just sort of making stuff up as they went. The sacrifices were being offered in the tabernacle, and they just kind of did with them whatever they wanted. There was sexual sin among the priests. There's all sorts of bad things happening in that church. And so the people at large, they didn't have a real good direction forward. But then we also see that they're impatient. Okay, they're impatient. They lost a battle, and they're like, "We can fix this. We can make it right. We can get back on track. Let's go. Let's keep going. Let's do something now." And so, sort of impetuously, they just quickly just throw a dart at the wall and see if it sticks. Okay, and they choose to bring the Ark of God with them into battle. So let's talk about the Ark for a second. Okay, just make sure we're on the same page. This was a wooden box. Okay, it had gold on the inside, gold on the outside. It was sort of a time capsule. Okay, God had the people put a copy of the Ten Commandments in the box. Later on, he'd added a jar of manna. He added a staff, basically a piece of driftwood that budded a new green. It started to grow again. It was sort of a time capsule of things that had happened from Israel's history. But that ark, that box, it was supposed to stay in one place. Okay, literally, it was supposed to stay in the tabernacle. So think their cathedral, their church building. It was supposed to stay there in the tabernacle always. If ever it needed to move, the priests were supposed to carry it. But they weren't even supposed to touch it. They were just supposed to put poles in the hooks, lift it up, carry it, drop it back off where it's supposed to go. And it had stayed in the same place for about 400 years, in this place called Shiloh. Okay, that's where the people were worshiping, at the tabernacle. This is pre-temple. This is the people offering sacrifices in this temple designed by God. So animal sacrifices, blood sacrifices. One more thing about this ark, it probably brings in the primary importance of what it's supposed to be used for, is one time per year, the high priest would go into the inner sanctuary of the tabernacle, do some animal sacrifices, and sprinkle blood on that box. Okay, that was for the atonement of his own sins. That was for atonement of the sins of the nation. That was kind of the primary function of the ark. Stay in place and be basically a receptacle for a mercy offering, a sacrifice for sin offering. And God would renew his covenant with his people. Remember, this is the Ark of the Covenant. This is the Ark of the Testimony. These are the things God promised to his people. So once a year, they gave special importance and significance to renew that promise. So that's the Ark. And yet, the Israelites here in this moment think, let's take it with us in battle, because maybe it will save us from our enemies. You can see they're using it as a good luck charm. Okay, or maybe they literally thought God lived in that box. You guys have heard the phrase, the saying, God in a box, or putting God in a box. Literally, then you can take him with you wherever you go. You can make him do whatever you want him to do. That's the idea of what they're going after here. Okay, just to give you some scripture references on the ark before I get ahead of myself. Exodus 25, Exodus 37, Leviticus 16. You're not writing this down. Oh, he's writing it down. Numbers 7, okay. The people try to use the ark for something it was not meant for. They take it into battle. Okay, God is not going to bless us trying to use him to accomplish our purposes. That's the bottom line. God won't bless our efforts to try and use him to get what we want. There's probably some reasons why they tried to do this. I thought it seems an awful lot like a compulsive gambler who just lost a lot of money and is going to try and quickly regain their losses. Let me just make one more bet. Let me just bet a little bit more this next time. Maybe I'm feeling lucky. It's kind of like they were hoping for something that really wasn't a good likely outcome, a good likelihood it was going to happen. It's this idea of doubling down, if we want to continue the gambling analogies. Can you guys remember where the idea of doubling down comes from? Anybody know? You shout it out. Nobody, that's good. Nobody's a gambler in here. Hey, well, like a few I used to be. So it comes from blackjack. When you have a good hand in blackjack, you place your initial bet. If you have good cards, you have the option to double the amount you're betting in hopes that you could double the amount that you win. Okay. Anybody know that already? Okay. Serious. Nobody knew that. Okay. Okay. Sinner. Nobody wanted to walk into that. That's really what was happening. But that's the idea of doubling down. Now, there's this phenomenon that happens with us humans that will double down, but not even in situations where we have a good hand. Not even in situations where things are good and we'll double down to try and do even better. Us humans, that's me, that's you, we'll double down when things are bad. When the situation's going wrong, I made a bad decision, it's not going the way that it should be or the way that's leading towards success. Let me just try a little bit harder. Let me just put a little bit more stress and emphasis. Let me just put a little more investment into it. And we'll try and recover that loss by doubling down. I might have been wrong the first time, but I think it'll work out in the end. Okay, in psychology, you call this cognitive dissonance. This idea that you can believe something that you want, and you can know something that's kind of the opposite, and they're a contradiction. But humans, we put hope into the equation, and we think, okay, but I still think it'll work, and so we do it anyway. So we do take action, we do things that are sort of against logic, against reason, two competing desires, two competing sets of facts, and we'll just go for it. Okay? And this drives therapists crazy. This drives pastors crazy, in case you were wondering. There's ways in which humans will double down. We'll know the same set of information, and we'll make the bad opposite choice. Okay, psychology might call that cognitive dissonance. There might be some strategies to try and deal with that sort of thing. Bible simplifies it for us, which is great. And I need this. I need the simple explanation. At its best, that's just foolish behavior. That's just foolishness. It's the category of, it's not wise, it's foolish, it's going to go bad. Maybe semi-innocent, at least not overtly evil. However, that is the worst case scenario. Best case is its foolishness. Worst case is its stubborn pride, which is a form of rebellion against God, which is a form of evil. Worst case, you're doing that because you're trying to go against what God is trying to steer you back toward. And you're just fighting against God. You say, I want to go over here, God. And I'm going to continue to go over here. I'm going to try and take you with me. Hey, the Bible calls this sin. Best case, it's foolishness. Definitely, it's a form of arrogance. Certainly, we're trying to maintain some control of our life. But that's what the Israelites are doing here. They're trying to force this decision to come true. God, we know we were supposed to win this battle. God, you need to come bless us. God, you need to do this for us because we know this is the right thing to do. They double down. Okay, I'm going to go this way and God is going to come with me. Okay, other reasons why they might have done it. I mentioned superstition. I think we do this. Our lucky shirt that we wear, you know, for the big game. Who puts on their Packer jersey when the Packers are playing? Do you do that out of hope that the Packers are going to win because you've done that? Or is it just for love of the sport? I think it's a mix of both. Okay, I got my lucky calculator. Is that just me? That's just me. Okay. I think there's ways in which we're superstitious about life. Again, we want to put some hope that the outcome that we want is going to come to fruition. So we'll do something to sort of hedge, sort of kind of influence that outcome. Anybody do this? You're just like non-interactive today. Thanks, Nick. Superstition. Okay, I think even Christians do this. I think there's ways in which we can turn our prayer into superstition. Or it's not communication with God. It's not honest, open, loving communication with God. We pray because we hope God blesses us, maybe. We pray because maybe he'll hear us this time when he seems like he hasn't been hearing us in the past. And it's not faith, it's superstition. I think we do this. Okay, we mentioned already as well, the priests are just bad. They don't know how to do their job. And so when they take the ark into battle, they might have literally just been confused. And this is leaders that you don't want to follow. Okay, people that are confused about where they're going, confused about how God is supposed to work. Okay, so there's a couple of different things that happened there. This aftermath of what happens now, okay, they lose the battle, then they lose the battle again, then they lose the ark. The aftermath is this woman gives birth and she names her son Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. Okay, a bitter moment. It's bittersweet. And it's true, the glory had departed. But it wasn't right in that moment that it happens. Okay, she's just realizing it for herself in that moment. Eli and his sons realized it for themselves. The people are realizing it then as well. But it's not then that the glory of God had departed. The people had left God behind a long time before this. They weren't following his ways. They weren't putting their trust and their faith in him. He didn't leave them. They left him. And that's mostly the story of the entire book of Judges, which incidentally is the time period that we're still talking about here. This time period of Samuel, this is before Israel gets a king, and that's coming up in the next couple weeks. is before. They have a king. They still are led by these kind of heroes, these quasi-prophets, these people that kind of are raised up into leadership, these judges. And the people are just aimless, and they're wandering, and they're bouncing around. A lot of people actually think Samuel was alive at the same time as Samson. Okay, it gives you some context of when this story is actually taking place. Dark period in Israel's history. Not a lot of clear, obvious direction. But the woman names her son Ichabod. The glory of God has departed. Okay. And they were aimless and they were wandering. And this is just going to continue until they finally get some new traction. Okay, that's going to take us into chapter 5. Why don't you open your Bibles? Let's read onward. It says, then the Philistines took the Ark of God and brought it from Ebenezer to Ashdod. When the Philistines took the Ark of God, they brought it into the house of Dagon and set it by Dagon. When the people of Ashdod arose early in the morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face to the earth before the Ark of the Lord. So they took Dagon and set it in its place again. And when they arose early the next morning, there was Dagon fallen on its face on the ground before the Ark of the Lord. The head of Dagon and both its palms of its hands were broken off on the threshold. Only Dagon's torso was left of it. Therefore, neither the priests of Dagon nor anyone who comes into Dagon's house tread on the threshold of Dagon in Ashdod to this day. The hand of the Lord was heavy on the people of Ashdod, and he ravaged them and struck them with tumors, both Ashdod and his territory. And when the men of Ashdod saw how it was, they said, the Ark of God of Israel must not remain with us, for his hand is harsh toward us and Dagon our God. Therefore, they sent and gathered to themselves all the lords of the Philistines, and they said, what shall we do with the Ark of the God of Israel? And they answered, let the Ark of the God of Israel be carried away to Gath. So they carried the Ark of God of Israel away. So it was after they had carried it away that the hand of the Lord was against the city with a very great destruction. And he struck the men of that city, both small and great, and tumors broke out on them. Therefore, they sent the Ark of God to Ekron. So it was as the Ark of God came to Ekron, the Ekronites cried out, saying, they have brought the Ark of God of Israel to us to kill us and our people. So they sent and gathered together all the lords of the Philistines, and they said, send away the Ark of God of Israel, and let it go back to its own place, so that it does not kill us and our people, for there was a deadly destruction throughout all the city. The hand of God was very heavy there, and the men who did not die were stricken with tumors, and the cry of the city went up to heaven. We'll stop there for a minute. So the Ark gets passed around from here. Okay, the Philistines now have it. They take it to their first city, and they put it in the temple of their god. And I don't know if they just wanted to like support their god, okay, maybe enhance his natural abilities, like give him some additional strength and power. What happens is a couple nights in a row, the statue of their god gets tipped off its pedestal. The first time it's lying face down, the second time it's broken apart. And they figure, okay, this must be because the Ark of God is there. But it gets worse for them, because all of a sudden the people start having tumors. They start having this plague. They start dying. And the people of the first city, which the first city was Ashdod, they're starting to freak out and panic. Okay, this is COVID-19 hitting them super hard. This is like them going, is it too soon? It's too soon. It's probably too soon. I'm sorry. I didn't mean it. This is a plague hitting them very, very hard. And so they get their leaders together and they say, okay, what should we do? Well, they decide, let's just send it to another Philistine city. They don't want to be, you know, dying and have the plague in their city. So their solution is to send it to the second place called Gath. And the same thing repeats there. Tumors, death. There's all sorts of bad things that are happening. Okay, the people in the second city, Gath, they decide the same thing. We got to send this away. So where do they decide to send it to? Hey, this isn't like go put it out in the Mediterranean Sea and let it sink to the bottom. No, let's just send it to somebody else and they can deal with it as long as we're in the clear. This is the way of the world. This is self-preservation. This is people trying, you know, to fend for their own, to make sure that they're protected and safe. And there's sort of this natural instinct in us that protects ourselves and basically makes sure that we endure, and there's something that's not wrong about that. However, to put others at harm at the sake of your own, that is wrong. Okay, that's the opposite of what God would tell us to do. He says, no greater love than to lay down your life for your friend. He says, consider others as better than yourself. Consider their needs first. Okay. Philistines don't know God. They don't know this. There's not, you know, for them, there's nothing here that they would know any better. But this certainly paints a picture of the way of the world. You know, we go to sell our car, put it on Facebook Marketplace or Craigslist. We might know that it needs a new set of tires or the brakes are wearing down. And yet we still set the price of that. You know, what are the Kelley Blue Book categories? It's like very good, good. We always pick a little bit higher than we should. Well, they can inherit our problem with our car, and then they can fix it when they're ready. Okay. Try and get the most money out of it. If you're honest, you'll disclose that stuff. If you're even more honest, you'll fix it up before you sell it. We do stuff like that. So you buy a car, and you're like, oh, man, dealership didn't tell me this and that. Then you end up paying for it. It's like my mom recently. She bought a house that really awesome, charming, cute cottage. Or not cottage. It's a house. Okay, I'm looking for my wife, but I can't see her. They didn't tell her about all the plumbing issues that they had tried to fix, but unsuccessfully did. Okay, so she bought the house, enjoyed living there for the last 5 years. Now all of a sudden, the tub downstairs won't drain. Now all of a sudden, she's got plumbers coming in to try and fix it. Now she can't use the shower downstairs. Somebody was trying to make some money. Somebody decided that it was better for them that you paid and they didn't. There's all sorts of extreme examples we could give, too. I was reading the news. There's a couple, they went mountain climbing in Australia. They're climbing the tallest mountain in Australia. The guy was recently convicted of manslaughter for leaving his girlfriend on top of the mountain. Okay, now there's all sorts of like conflicting and confusing stories. The jury convicted him of manslaughter. He left her up there. Weather turned bad. Situation got bad. He left. Okay. Now, her family, they actually sided with him, and they said, no, our daughter took responsibility for her own actions. This is on her. She, you know. But on the way down the mountain, he turned off his phone, and she was messaging him still. He waited to alert the authorities for longer than, it was deemed longer than he should have. Okay, there's all sorts of things where he did some kind of fishy stuff. But honestly, I think the killer, or the strong testimony that hurt his case the most was, a number of years ago, he dated another gal. They went mountain climbing on a mountain in Europe. The weather got bad, turned, and he left her behind. Don't date this guy, girls. Don't. No matter how good looking he is, no matter how much money he has, this is a selfish man. He will leave you to die. Okay, that should be like maybe the lowest bar of who not to date. But extreme example, but somebody that when he thought, I need to make sure that I survive, I'm willing to even let the closest person to me suffer and die. Okay, now I don't know much more about those cases. I tell you, when I read the news, I like half read it too, and then my imagination kind of fills in the gaps. So hopefully, I didn't just lie to you. Okay. But I think the story is fitting. In the Salem witch trials in the 16, 17, whatever hundreds here in the U.S. people were accused of being witches. They had no evidence to say that they weren't, since they were going to get burned at the stake. Their only out was to accuse other people of being witches, which got them off the hook. But then people they know and loved were burned. People are willing to weasel out, to get out of danger, even if it means putting somebody else into danger. That's the way of humanity. So it's selfish, it's self-seeking, it's self-preserving. That's the Philistines. That's what they're doing here. But I will tell you, when we get into chapter 6, we're going to see the Israelites do the same thing. They know God, they know better, and we're going to watch them do virtually the same thing. You can decide when we get to it. Now, one side note before we move forward. Okay, the Ark of God is lost. This is the object that kind of confirms their covenant with God. This is a very important thing. I mean, best I can tell, this is the equivalent of a wedding ring. You know, this is the kind of the thing that seals the deal for them. Represents their relationship with God, and they do nothing to get it back. They make no effort here. They don't go after it. They don't, you know, try to go find it. And maybe it's just that not enough time had passed. But I'll be honest, it's almost as if they wanted to feel sorry for themselves. Okay, it's almost as if they'd grown accustomed to being apart from God, from being in the pattern of feeling like, failure again. And they've almost grown kind of to like that place. It's like when you're swimming and there's a nice warm spot that you find, you know, you just stay put for a minute and then you start to think about it and you're like, wait a minute, something's wrong. But they'd almost grown accustomed to this place where they could stay because it was familiar. It's easier to be in a place of disappointment. It's easier to be in a place of, I don't know, distance from God. And they wanted to feel sorry for themselves. I'm reading into this a little bit, but I think there's reason to believe that they actually just wanted to stay in this low, sorry state. Okay, you can tell what's important to a person by what they're willing to go after, by what they're willing to look for, by the effort they take to find it. Think for a second about the lesser things in life that you are willing to put effort into finding, and the extent at which you'll go. I mean, you lose your cell phone, what do? You bug your spouse, and you're like, have you seen my phone? Okay. Can you call it? Like, there's just the natural progression. Have you seen my keys? Have you seen my wallet? Have you seen these things? I'll give you a gross example. I've dropped my phone in the toilet before. I went in after it. I promise you I did. And then I sold it on Facebook, and now it's that person's problem. But it's a phone, and it was gross. And I was willing to do it because, I don't know, it seemed important at the time. We're willing to go for lesser things. We're willing to go to extreme for lesser things. Will we actually go for it with God? Or will we sit back and wait? Will we kind of stay in that low position? It's not like it used to be. I've kind of lost what I used to have with God. Or I just don't know if God's willing to hear me. And then we just feel sorry for ourselves and stay in a position where we're apart from God. Will we seek God? Will we make an effort? Okay, or will we just resign ourselves? I guess this is how it's going to be. Okay, let's jump into chapter 6. It says, now the ark of the Lord was in the country of the Philistines for 7 months. And the Philistines called for the priests and the diviners, saying, what shall we do with the ark of the Lord? Tell us how we should send it to its place. So they said, if you send away the ark of God of Israel, do not send it empty, but by all means return it with a trespass offering. Then you will be healed, and it will be known to you why his hand is not removed from you. Then they said, what is the trespass offering which we shall return to him? They answered, 5 golden tumors and 5 golden rats, according to the number of the lords of the Philistines. For the same plague was on all of you and on your lords. Therefore you shall make images of your tumors and your images of your rats that ravage the land, and they shall give glory to the God of Israel. Perhaps he will lighten his hand from you, from your gods, and from your land. Why then do you harden your hearts as the Egyptians and Pharaoh hardened their hearts? Why did, when he did mighty things among them, did they not let the people go that they might depart? Now therefore make a new cart. Take 2 milk cows, which have never been yoked, hitch the cows to the cart, take their calves home and send them away. Then take the ark of the Lord, set it on the cart, and put the articles of gold, which you are returning to him as a trespass offering, in a chest by its side. Then send it away and let it go. And watch. If it goes up the road to its own territory, to Beth Shemesh, then he has done us this great evil. But if not, then we shall know that it was not by his hand that he struck us. It happened to us by chance. Then the men did so. So they took 2 milk cows and hitched them to the cart and shut up their calves at home. And they set the ark of the Lord on the cart and the chest with the gold rats and the images of their tumors. Then the cows headed straight for the road to Beth Shemesh and went along the highway, lowing as they went. It did not turn aside to the right hand or to the left. And the lords of the Philistines went after them to the border of Beth Shemesh. Now the people of Beth Shemesh were reaping their wheat harvest in the valley, and they lifted their eyes and saw the ark and rejoiced to see it. Then the cart came into the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh and stood there. A large stone was there,
So they split the wood of the cart and offered the cows as a burnt offering to the Lord. The Levites took down the ark of the Lord and the chest that was with it, in which were the articles of gold, and put them on the large stone. Then the men of Beth Shemesh offered burnt offerings and made sacrifices the same day to the Lord. So when the five lords of the Philistines had seen it, they returned to Ekron that same day. These are the golden tumors which the Philistines returned as a trespass offering to the Lord, one for Ashdod, one for Gaza, one for Ascalon, one for Gath, one for Ekron. And the golden rats, according to the number of the cities, of all the cities of the Philistines belonging to the five lords, both fortified cities and country villages, even as far as the large stone of Abel, of which they set the ark of the Lord, which stone remains to this day in the field of Joshua of Beth Shemesh. Then he struck the men of Beth Shemesh, because they had looked inside the ark. He struck 50,070 men of the people, and the people lamented because the Lord had struck the people with a great slaughter. And the men of Beth Shemesh said, "Who is able to stand before this holy Lord God? And to whom shall it go from us?" So they sent messengers to the inhabitants of Kirjath-Jearim, saying, "The Philistines have brought back the ark of the Lord. Come down and take it up with you." And the men of Kirjath-Jearim came and took the ark of the Lord and brought it into the house of Abinadab on the hill and consecrated Eleazar his son to keep the ark of the Lord. All right, so the Philistines get rid of the ark. They get it out of their territory. Their strategy, build a cart, hook up some cows that had never plowed a field before, set the ark, and then set some gold sort of tribute offering on there. And you may have noticed they made gold statues shaped like tumors. So I'm thinking they were lazy. Here's a hunk of gold. It's a tumor. You know, it's not a hunk of gold. It's a tumor. They send this up the road, and they say wherever it goes to, we'll know if it goes back to Israel, then it was because we had the ark that these bad things were happening to us. If not, then we'll know this is all by chance, and we're just kind of fooling ourselves. Well, sure enough, the cows take the ark of God, pulled it on a cart, and they go straight back to Israel. The city it goes to, Beth Shemesh, it's a city of Levite priests. So everybody there would have been familiar. They would have recognized the ark. This had to be the weirdest parade happening. The people are working in the field, and all of a sudden, two cows pulling a cart come down over the hill, and a whole group of Philistines is like tiptoeing along after, just like watching. But the ark returns to Israel. It shows up in this guy's field. So instantly, they kill the cows, they start a fire, and they offer the cows as a burnt offering to God. And this is where it gets even weirder. You say, how could this get even weirder? This is where it gets weirder. Then God kills 70 of the Israelites because they looked inside the ark. So God causes the ark to come back home to Israel. And they're all excited. They celebrate. They do burnt offerings. But then God kills 70 of the Israelite, the Levite priests, because they presumptuously opened the ark and looked inside of it. And you think, why did they do that? I mean, is it like little kids saying, like, well, let's just look inside. Here's our only chance that we'll ever get. It's curiosity. Maybe it was more noble than that. Let's check and see if the Philistines stole anything out of the ark. But it doesn't matter. Okay, so God kills 70 of them. In some of your Bibles, including what I read, it says 50,070. My understanding is a better translation is 70 of 50,000 total. So he kills 70 men of 50,000 total, not 50,000. And then the people are afraid. They're like, what do we do now? Who can stand before this holy God? That's their what they're quoted as saying. And certainly they don't want it to be them. And so they start asking around and they find another Israelite city and say, will you take this from us? Because they're afraid. Okay, so they end up doing the same thing as the Philistines do virtually. Let's talk about this for a minute. Okay, the cows take the ark directly back to Israel. Certainly this can tell us that God is in control. I mean, did this happen by chance? You know, the Philistines are like a little bit superstitious in what they do, but they say if it goes back to Israel, we'll know. But the ark goes back to Israel, and God certainly controlled this entire situation. He can get nature to do what he wants it to do. He can get the world and history to do what he wants it to do. He can get you and I to do what he wants us to do. Okay, and in this case, he got the Philistines to do it willingly. He didn't literally twist their arm, but he kind of turned up the pressure, didn't he? Causes some things that caused them to want to give it up. There's a couple ways we can look at this. How does God get people to do what he wants? Well, oftentimes he melts their heart. He gets them to love him. And then they do what he wants because it's what they want. But other times it's opposition. It's people who reluctantly agree to the fact that God is stronger than they are. God is in control of all things. Okay, they still do it willingly, but begrudgingly. And again, it's probably the Philistines in this situation. You guys know the Aesop's fable where it's the sun versus the wind trying to compete to decide who's stronger? You guys heard this one before? I remember this from being a kid. Okay, so here's the premise. The sun and the wind have an argument about who's stronger. Okay, and so they devise this contest for how do they determine who the winner is, who is actually stronger. And so they say, okay, that guy over there, we'll see which one of us can get him to take off his jacket first. Okay, so just a random person on earth, poor, unsuspecting minion. They see who can get the guy to take off his jacket first. So the wind goes first, and the wind blows and blows. You know, first he tries to get the guy's jacket off by force, and then by cooling, you know, down the temperature, and then by force again. And all that does is cause the man to tighten his grip. Tighten the belt on his jacket. I'm imagining a trench coat, just so you know. Hold on to that jacket even tighter. And finally, the wind gives up because he gets tired. The sun calmly steps forward and just slowly turns up the thermostat, turns up the heat. Man, the guy in the story, after a while, he's like, oh, it's getting warm in here. Okay, and just casually unbuttons his jacket, takes it off willingly. Because it's too warm now to be wearing a jacket. That's a lot of what this is like. God can get us to do what he wants us to do. But he puts us in a situation where it's going to be willingly. And the question is whether or not it's begrudgingly or thankfully. You know, respectfully or not. Jesus says there's one day that every knee will bow. And again, that'll be willingly or unwillingly. There's going to be a lot of people that bow before God to worship him in heaven. There's going to be a lot of people who bow before God and say, man, you were right. There is a difference. Okay, here he gets the Philistines to send back the ark. But God's in control of history. God can get us to do what he wants us to do. But there is this idea of free will that comes into play. Okay, and here you see the Philistines did it willingly. Last part we'll talk about, we'll wrap this up. God gets angry here at the end. And I think this one can be a little bit hard to take. This isn't the only time that God kills somebody because they touched or looked at the ark. A couple chapters from now, there's a guy who's walking alongside the ark. The cart that the ark is on kind of like hits a bump. The guy reaches out his hand to steady the ark. And God kills him. I'll let somebody else explain that one to you later. But this can be really hard to take. The bottom line here is God is holy. Why does God get mad? Why does God kill these people? God is holy. Okay, there is protocol for the ark. It's supposed to be only the priests, and they weren't supposed to touch it. Once a year, it's only supposed to be the high priest going in to sprinkle blood and visit before the Lord. These people that looked inside the ark were very presumptuous. They did what God told them not to do. Okay, and it was a severe punishment. But these aren't people that are actively, willingly following the Lord at this point in time either. These aren't people that are on board with what he's trying to do. They kind of see this religious trinket come back into their life and they think, well, let's see what we can get out of it. Okay, or maybe they had good hearts toward it, but they just still totally ignored the thing God told them not to do. Look, the relationship we have with God is a relationship. If we don't respect what he says and does, we certainly don't give him the authority that he's supposed to have in our lives. If we don't obey what he tells us to do, we can't really say that we love him. God is holy. That means he's just other, totally different. Different than we are. Unique. And the things that he asks us to do are things that are, he at least expects us to have some operation of faith, trust, love. So these guys look inside the ark, and they end up paying the price for it. Because they didn't respect God, didn't respect his holiness, they didn't worship him, they didn't trust him. The question for us is, will we? Even in little things. I mean, maybe that's the hardest part to take here. Gosh, it seems innocent enough. I can imagine why they would have looked. I'm the kind of guy that would look. That scares me even worse. Me and Dane would be opening up the ark. I'm just being honest. I want to be helpful, so I'll just presume that helpfulness is better than holiness in this moment. That's me. Okay, I know some of you are like that. This is where following God isn't about being a good person. It's not about just being a nice person. And this is where following God is about obeying him, respecting him, trusting him, following him. Okay, and these stories are hard sometimes to take and even hard to understand. But if we believe that God's holy and we believe that caring about his holiness is more important than being helpful, then I think you won't have a hard time at least learning from it. Okay. Now these people send the ark away and they're terrified. What's going to happen to the rest of us? Who can stand before this holy God? Okay, and so they're going to send the ark away. From here, we're going to see Samuel grow up. It stays there in this new final city for 20 years. In that time, Samuel will grow up and be about 30 years old. Okay, and start a ministry that kind of starts to lead the people back. So that's next time. That'll be next week when we get into chapter 7. Let's pray.